You know, I think one thing that I do come back to sometimes is this phrase, I love myself, therefore. So I love myself, therefore I will make the choice that honors my body. I love myself, therefore I will work my hardest, or I love myself, therefore I'll do my best. You know, it's like, I love myself, therefore, and then you insert like the attitude or behavior you're going to carry out in support of loving yourself.
Hi, I'm Coach MK, founder of the Fitness Protection Program. I'm a run coach, not a life coach. We're never really talking about the running. Running is the tool. It's the conduit we use to examine the world we live in, as well as its impact on our own lives and the lives of the people around us. How we react to certain people and to certain stories tells us a lot about how we view ourselves. I'm committed to the thoughtful, intentional exploration of the importance of running so that no one discounts their own badassery, ever. Final note, this podcast is geared towards every runner who won't lose their home, livelihood, or health insurance if they show up to the corral with a hangover. Not that I'm encouraging you to do that, just saying. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the Fitness Protection Podcast.
So hi, everyone. Coach Sarah here. Coach MK is up to her elbows in kids. So I will be interviewing Sarah Canny, also known as Run Far Girl, founder and host of Rise Run Retreat and author of the popular running blog Run Far Girl. Sarah Canny has developed a loyal following thanks to her authentic voice and talent for storytelling. After battling an eating disorder for nearly 10 years as a young adult, Sarah found freedom and healing. Running proved a catalyst in her transformation as she learned to rewrite the negative narrative in her head and find a unique strength within herself. As Sarah became more involved in the running community, she was inspired by the connections she had made to create Rise Run Retreat in 2015. Sarah's mission is to help women gain confidence, find strength, and make authentic connections through running. As the host, she creates a place for women to be inspired and experience personal growth through running. Sarah is also an RRCA and USATF running coach, and since she began running in 2003, has become a competitive mountain runner and was a member of the 2018 U.S. National Snowshoe Running Team, finishing 9th at the World Snowshoe Championships in 2019. Sarah is unapologetically herself, which translates to very candid conversations and meaningful connections with her audience. Sarah, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
This is really, really exciting. And there are so many touch points in your work that I'm really looking forward to talking about. But first, I really want to talk about snowshoe running, yeah. Which I had never heard those two things in the same sentence until I found you. And actually, one of our members, when I wrote on our Facebook page that I was going to interview, she said, oh, I know her. She's amazing. Ask her about snowshoe running. So I got to ask
awesome.
You. When did you start doing this? How hard is it? Because it sounds really hard. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I started snowshoe running in 2014. I had just kind of come off of a really good marathon training cycle and kind of was having just a lot of self-imposed pressure on myself about what pace I should be running when I'm out on the road, and did it measure up and did it match up? And I found this snowshoe race kind of randomly, and it was a night race, which was super fun. So I needed a headlamp and I rented some snowshoes, and I just kind of jumped in, not really knowing what I was getting into, and was totally hooked. Like, I loved that. Well, first of all, it was snowing the night that of the race, which made it kind of super cool to run through the woods and the snow. And then I also just love that pace really didn't matter, and you were just kind of in your element out in the woods. And I don't know, all the aspects of it just really appealed to me for where I was as a runner at the time. And so since then, I've just any chance I can get, running and racing and participating.
That's incredible. What's the terrain like on a snowshoe race? Is it groomed? Is it trail?
So typically most snowshoe races are held, you know, on trails, and some will be at either a Nordic ski center or kind of a downhill, like a ski mountain that has a Nordic trails. So every race is typically a combination of groomed Nordic and then also powder. So fresh powder. So they'll take you off into some like single track through the fresh powder. So there's typically a little combination of both, which the varying terrain and also varying snow conditions really impact how difficult it is to run in the race. So it's a lot harder to run through fresh powder that's deep, a lot easier to run on the groomed Nordic, especially if it's kind of crusty hard snow versus like soft fresh snow. So, you know, you could run one race, like, so I ran a race this Saturday. It's a race that I've done multiple times, you know, and you can't really compare your times year to year because the snow conditions are so different year to year. So even though the course is the same, you can't really compare. There's a lot of variability that makes it kind of fun and interesting. And it's also just really pretty.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yes. I even just having it, you know, 3 inches of snow on the ground here, it's beautiful and magical looking to run out in it. But I think that what you're saying about, you know, basically having to show up to whatever the terrain is on that day and just take it as it is without any comparison in your head, just how pointless that would be to compare your past performances and that kind of thing. I think that that's so important and a reason that the source of so much mental struggle, I think, for runners has to do with that pace and always needing to be competing against your past self, the other younger versions of you that are out there. And it can really take the fun and the joy out of running. And I wonder if any of that in your head was connected with sort of your struggles with restricted eating and other things in the past, you know, that's a kind of need to control and always know that you're improving. Did you find that that was kind of an outgrowth of that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that sort of rigidity and sort of measuring up to expectation, like all of that is sort of ingrained in my personality. And it's definitely something that, like, as I get older and wiser and I'm just working through, like, how do you set aside self-imposed expectations? How do you let go of perceived expectations from the people around you? You know, and how do you kind of enter into things that push that comfort zone and kind of put you on the edge of where you feel uncomfortable and in control versus where you feel a little bit uncomfortable and out of control. And I think that's probably why I like snowshoe running so much, is because it forces that growth. And also I feel really connected to kind of my roots growing up in New Hampshire as like just an outdoorsy family, outdoorsy kid, just like being in the woods, in the snow, like, it just feels like very, I don't know, very happy to me. It's like a lot of my really good childhood memories are from, you know, just being in the snow, you know, with my family when I was a kid.
So it's like a connection to your inner child in some ways.
Exactly. Yeah.
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 And sure. Do you find that that mentality shift that you experience in snowshoe running, does that translate over into your road running and other aspects of your life? Are you able to tap into that mindset sometimes in other places too?
Yeah, totally. I really think that sort of the more that I've gone into the snowshoe running, the more I've kind of opened myself up to that, the more growth I've seen in other areas of my life, the way these sort of lessons that I'm learning just out on the snow kind of translate to either my personal life or the road running, you know, and just finding ways to let go a little bit more and find joy and ease in things rather than being so rigid and so bound by expectation.
Yeah. So this is something that I want to touch on possibly a little later too, because I think a lot of our community has found in the ultra running mentality kind of a similar mindset shift. And I was really struck by this. I've only ever participated in one ultra marathon, and it was, you know, on a looped course. It's called 3 Days at the Fair. We're taking a big group of our people, our fitness protection people there this year. And one thing that I just loved seeing there was how many people would just stop and walk, like, whenever. And in fact, I did like a 12-hour event, and I started kind of towards the end. And when I started, it was 9 p.m. It was nice and cool outside. I was feeling really fresh. So I was just like jogging and jogging and jogging. And everyone's looking at me like, you know, you can stop and walk if you want to. And I was the weird one for not stopping to walk kind of whenever. And I had never thought before showing up to that event that I had any interest in ultra running. But when I was there, I was like, oh, I get it. I get it. There is a different focus here. People are here to get such a different thing. And people are not here to race each other in the sense of time. They're here to see how far they can go and what they can do. A lot of people walk the entire time they're there. They're just there to walk as many loops as they possibly can. And I just loved that. I loved that it entirely took how fast you're going, how fast you're moving your body out of the equation and removed, really, I think, that potential for constant comparison and panic about what the people around you are doing.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to talking about your experiences with eating disorders. And I've read your biography and I've read a lot of your writing, and I think it's really beautiful. I would love to hear you, for those of our folks who have not read up on you, if you could tell us kind of when you remember your awareness of this first beginning. When did you become aware of fatness and your body in comparison to other people around you, and start to think about, am I close to this line? If I am, what does that mean? Do you remember when those thoughts first crept in?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it was, I think, a pretty distinct moment, you know, around the age of 10 or 11, where, you know, I had started to put on more weight than some of the girls around me, and was made fun of on some occasions where, you know, I was jumping on a trampoline and someone made fun of me because they said I was going to break the trampoline because I was bigger than everybody else. Or, you know, and I can remember on the basketball, you know, I was playing basketball and, like, you know, I was the slowest and nobody wanted to pass to me. And, you know, just little things like that as a kid where you just, there's a slow sort of awareness of, like, okay, I'm other, like, I'm not like the other kids. Like, I don't look like them. I can't run like them. I don't fit in. And so I think it was really around that age that I really kind of became aware. You know, it was around that time too that the doctor, you know, at just a regular physical, the doctor was talking to my mom, you know, and I'm sitting right there and the doctor saying, well, she's really over, you know, overweight for her age and height and BMI and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, just being aware of those conversations and just kind of thinking like, okay, there's something wrong with me, you know? And so I think that sort of begins this insecurity and like, well, I'm not good enough because I'm not like everyone else, or, you know, there's this thing that's wrong with me, but don't really know how to fix it. So I must be wrong, you know? So I really think that it was kind of around that age that it started. And then I would say sort of those early teen years was kind of when I started to just experiment with restricting and dieting and, you know, rice cakes and, you know, fat-free yogurt. And it's interesting because around the same time, right around those same ages, both my grandfathers, my mom's side, my dad's side, had heart attacks. So at that time, like, diet, fat, cholesterol, like, became a very sort of prominent thing in our family because my parents were concerned of the hereditary implications of having their fathers have had heart attacks. And so there was just sort of general awareness around food and fat and, you know, what's good, what's bad. And so I think that kind of just like morphed into just me being very hyper aware of what I was eating, hyper aware of what I looked like, and wanting to do something about it. You know, so I can remember like picking up Seventeen magazine and Shape magazine at the library. My mom didn't get anything like that. You know, she didn't subscribe to any kind of magazines like that. And I wasn't allowed to check them out and bring them home, but I would like sneak read them at the library. And yes, just like trying to glean any kind of diet tips that I could from these magazines. And so kind of those early teen years, kind of then into high school, I think high school was really kind of where things started to solidify more. And I became even more aware that, like, okay, I'm not attractive. You know, everybody has a boyfriend. I don't, you know, that kind of thing. Like, just feeling like I don't fit in. And so it was kind of in those, like, my sophomore year into junior, senior year, where I just started to drop weight and lose weight.
Do you remember when you first, like, realized that you were doing that, that you were the one manipulating your weight, and that, you know, oh, if I can do this, then what if I could do more? And
yeah, I distinctly remember the summer between my freshman year of high school and my sophomore year of high school was kind of when I probably gave the dieting the most effort. And when we went to go back to school shopping, I had to get a smaller size. And, you know, that was validation. And then the scale was also validating that as well. And then when we finally went back to school, I got so many validating comments of, like, wow, Sarah, you look so good. You lost weight. Like, wow, you look, you know. And so that then became more impetus to continue with the habits that I'd already been sort of developing.
Yeah. Do you remember whether your mother talked to you after that doctor's appointment, where you first remember your doctor commenting on your weight and your BMI and that kind of thing? Did she, was there any sort of debrief after that with her, or did she kind of, what did she do? What do you remember about her reaction?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's so long ago that it's hard to, like, pinpoint, but, like,
totally.
My parents were always just really encouraging and supportive and didn't want weight to be an issue. I think because I recall my mom talking about the fact that when she was growing up, her weight was an issue with her mother. And so, you know, just like, she did not want that to be present, you know, in our relationship in the way that it was with her mother. So I did know that, but I don't specifically recall, like, a debrief or what she said or anything like that.
Yeah. Oh, it must have been hard for her to hear that. I mean, especially if she was sort of processing her own relationship with her weight and her mother. And my daughter is 4, but I think all the time about when we're going to get to the point where these questions are in her head and on her mind. And it wasn't too long ago that we were out for the day at a farm, I think, with some friends of ours who we hadn't seen in a while. And both kids are 4. Their son used to go to school with my daughter. And his dad said something along the lines of, like, oh yeah, I always noticed that, you know, the two of them were the chubbiest kids in their class. I mean, what, like, and I just wondered if it was something in the water in our apartment building. And I just kind of looked at him like, is that what you see when you look at my kid? I completely shut down at that point. I really just, like, had to step away from everybody, and my ears were ringing. And I realized that we're essentially already at that point, because it starts so soon. Everyone looks at other people's bodies, especially kids' bodies, and has something to say. And I'm always wondering, when are we gonna have that first occurrence of somebody, possibly like a doctor, saying something, and her hearing that, and me being in the room, and what am I gonna do when we get there? And, you know, no matter how much I want her relationship with her body to be different from mine growing up, because what you were saying before about around the age when you realized that you were different, that's about the age that it happened to me too. And I just kind of went through high school with blinders on, trying to ignore the fact that maybe I could manipulate my weight if I wanted to. It was all very scary to me, and I didn't get to the point of going on diets until I was in college. But I remember that feeling of, everyone else can run the mile and I can't. Everyone else can just effortlessly play these sports and I can't. And so, yeah, I find myself really thinking about how this will be part of my general dialogue with my daughter as she grows up. I know that you have kids. How old are your kids?
Yeah, so I have a daughter who's 10 and two boys who are 7 and 4. So,
oh wow.
So yeah.
So you're getting to that point already.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, those conversations have already cropped up a little bit. You know, we're at the beach and, you know, a cousin or a friend has a bikini on, and my daughter says, like, well, why is her stomach so flat and mine isn't? You know, something like that. And, you know, I think that approaching those conversations as honestly as you possibly can while being encouraging and positive is the best way to go about it. I think it's an important conversation to have. So you don't want to brush over it and be like, oh, well, just that's what it is. Or, you know, and so in that instance, I think, you know, my response was probably something along the lines of, well, everybody's body takes different shapes and, you know, depending on who we are and how tall we are. And so just talking about people's uniqueness and focusing in on that as a really positive characteristic and trait is one way to tackle it. But I think trying to find a way to spin it in a way that builds strength and confidence in your child is an important way to do that.
One of the questions that came in from our community, and there are a lot of people in our community who love you and have followed you for a long time and are actively struggling with this right now, whether you have any suggestions or insights about how to best support teenagers in recovery from eating disorders who are on the verge of making that transition to adulthood where hopefully they get to be more and more in control. Because I think the fear, and I already relate to this fear, even though I'm nowhere near this with my daughter, the fear is that, you know, what if they turn 18, they leave the house, and they stop choosing recovery? And what is there to do about it at that point? That's not an easy question, I know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing, I can understand the sort of the family member side of it. Just my husband we've been together since I was 19. And when I was 19, was kind of in the thick of the worst of my eating disorder. And so he's kind of been there through the whole thing. And, you know, I've talked to him extensively about his side of things. And then, you know, obviously I have my own experience. And I think the most important thing is that, you know, just thinking about the pivotal moment for me that kind of moved me from this kind of ongoing recovery situation to actually feeling recovered and being behavior free for the last almost 11 years now.
Oh, is wow. That, congratulations.
Thank you. That I finally learned to love and honor and appreciate myself. And so that sort of pivotal moment of really grasping and understanding what it meant to love myself and take care of myself and value myself as I am was critical in me kind of moving from that recovery to recovered. And I think, you know, thinking about my husband and sort of his role in my recovery, the most impactful thing that he did was love me unconditionally. It wasn't the tough love, come to Jesus speech. It wasn't you know, the kind of in your face kind of thing. It wasn't the not saying anything. It wasn't like for him, the thing that was most impactful that he did was to just be steady and love me unconditionally and to let me know that, you know, to be there, to express that love, to express that support, I think is so key. And I think sometimes, you know, coming from a position of a concerned friend or family member, a lot of times your concern kind of can turn into anxiety, then can be projected onto that person who's in recovery. And so if that anxiety is being projected onto them, that can sometimes come across as anger, frustration. You're frustrated that they're not recovering. You're frustrated that they're not well. And it's all from a place like of love. You love them so dearly. You want them to be better, but they're just not. And you see the destructive behavior. You see the destructive patterns and they don't. And there can be frustration and anger there. And I think it's just so important to acknowledge that that's there, but work to really find that place of unconditional love so that when you're approaching that person who's in recovery, that it's with just love and acceptance, because ultimately the pivotal moment for them is going to be when they learn to love and accept themselves. So if you can model that and give that to them in the best way possible, then they are much more likely to arrive at that place of personal love and acceptance that is ultimately going to be that turning point for them.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's really beautiful. And I think you're absolutely right. It's so hard from the family member's perspective to give someone that without putting on them all of your worry about them, which creates this sense of responsibility and guilt. And I just think it's so hard. And I would like to, in response to this person's question, I would also emphasize that because it's so important for you to show them that unconditional love without hopefully projecting your anxiety about them, that's also because, you know, you really need to be taken care of too. You need to have someone else outside of the person you're supporting to support you and to be the receptacle for your anxiety. Because it's not that, you know, you can't just put your anxiety and your worries and your fears away. Your feelings do matter. And especially if you've struggled with this in your life, it's got to be immensely triggering to watch anyone, let alone your child, go through something like this. So there are a lot of parallels between me and you. I also met my husband when I was 19, and we've been together for a long time now. And I was recently diagnosed with depression. And his reaction to that at first was, he said, "Well, so what do you think about that?" And I said, "Well, I mean, I just think they just took one look at me and said, why don't I give you an antidepressant? Because they didn't want to deal with whatever else is going on." And he was like, "Okay." And I was like, "I'll keep going to see my therapist, but, you know, I'll be fine." And he was like, "Okay." And then a couple days later, he sat me down and just said, "Look, I've been thinking a lot about this, and we need to start looking at this differently, because you are trying really hard. You are doing a lot of work, and trying hard isn't helping anymore." But the way he came into that, I was kind of expecting him to be like, "Listen, you gotta get it together, or else, you know, I'm gonna leave or something." And I was terrified. I was shaking as he sat me down to have this conversation. But the way that it was presented as, "I love you, and I want you to have the help that you deserve," that immediately made me see both how much he loved me and how much I did indeed need to figure out a way to get more help. And it was a huge turning point for me. And the first thing that I did once I kind of felt like I had myself under control was say to him, "You probably should see a therapist too, because you've been living with me for a long time. You've been dealing with this for a long time. And as we go through this, you're going to have a lot of feelings come up about some of the things that I've probably put you through. And you're going to need a place to put that that's not me." I really believe that, because you can't put those feelings away, but it's worth it to seek out a place for you to process what you're going through.
Yeah, I think that seeking professional help on both sides, whether you're the supporting party or the person who's actually struggling with the eating disorder, it's so critical for just healing and well-being all around. Because there can be a lot of hurt, you know, when you care so much about somebody and you see them in this really destructive behavior pattern. There's a lot of opportunity for straining the relationship and hurting the relationship, and you definitely don't want that. So yeah, I think seeking professional help on both ends is so important.
And so I want to go back to the turning point that you mentioned a little while ago, when you really found yourself able to extend yourself that unconditional love. Do you remember sort of the circumstances that you found yourself in that finally allowed you to get to that place?
Yeah, I do. So, you know, As I mentioned, I had been struggling kind of all through high school and then into my college years and then beyond into my early mid-20s. You know, and all through that time, I was kind of in and out of different, you know, outpatient treatment and then seeing different therapists and, you know, just finding treatment in any way that we could afford, you know, that insurance would cover or that we had enough money to cover out of pocket, which always wasn't necessarily sufficient when I needed it most. You know, I did a lot of work and moved and progressed forward, but there was always relapse and the behavior just persisted for a really long time. I found out that I was pregnant, which kind of came as an unexpected surprise to both my husband and I, just because I had struggled with amenorrhea and we kind of weren't really planning on it. And and so, you know, I can remember taking the pregnancy test, you know, and at the time, you know, I took the pregnancy test quite late because it wasn't something that we were planning, but all of a sudden I had these just weird symptoms and I was like, what is going on with my body? And so I took a pregnancy test and I was, I think like already like maybe 8 to 10 weeks pregnant at that point. So it was kind of, you know, pretty well along.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I can remember coming home from work one day and just feeling the urge to binge and purge and, you know, kind of stepped into the bathroom to do that and hesitated. I paused and just, you know, was thinking about the fact that like, okay, there's a baby inside me now. You know, I don't want to continue with this harmful behavior because I don't want to harm or hurt the baby. And so in that moment, I kind of realized that it was not about me, but it was all about me at the same time. Because if I really wanted to love and honor and nurture this baby in the best way possible, I actually first had to love, honor, and nurture myself. And so that realization that, okay, my body is a home to another life and I need to take care of this home, this vessel that's carrying this life. That comprehension of what that meant for my behavior really sunk in, that it had to come to an end and that if it didn't, you know, there was a lot of risk involved. And so, you know, risk for the baby, which of course there was risk for me and there had been all along in terms of like just, you know, bulimia can just be a really destructive habit in terms of just your health and your body. You know, I'd never associated that risk with things hurting me. It was just a choice that I was making and I really didn't think about the consequences too much. But I think being aware of the consequences and realizing that they weren't just affecting me proved to be a huge catalyst for making a decision to actually like just be done with the behavior.
Wow. That's really powerful.
Yeah.
I remember getting pregnant with my daughter and being in the grocery store and sort of, you know, being drawn to the weight loss magazines near the checkout like I always was, and having the desire to join Weight Watchers again. That was always my urge when I was feeling bad about my body in my 20s. Just, all right, I guess I'm going to join Weight Watchers again. I'm going to get back on the wagon and do that whole thing. And I realized that Weight Watchers would not take my money because I was pregnant. And that was a powerful moment for me. They don't want my money. I am not allowed to do that right now. This is different. And between that and the realization that not only should I let my belly stick out, but everyone expected me to let my belly stick out. And this was the time in my life where I was expected to do that, was very freeing. I like looking back at those moments and remembering how those things sunk in, because they are thoughts that I return to when I find myself struggling. Is there any sort of... So we actually have another podcast, Coach MK and I, called the Morning Mantra Podcast. And what we try to do is when someone writes to us with a situation that they're facing either in their lives, you know, outside of themselves or purely within themselves, what can they say? What is like a distilled anchor that they can return to remind themselves that they're okay, that all of decisions that they're making are good, and that they do have what it takes to move through this. Do you have any kind of mantras that you come back to when you struggle?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I have a million of them. So there's not like one that's like this, like, you know, anchor, I would say. But, you know, I think one thing that I do come back to sometimes is this phrase, I love myself, therefore. So I love myself, therefore I will make the choice that honors my body. I love myself, therefore I will work my hardest, or I love myself, therefore I'll do my best. You know, it's like, I love myself, therefore, and then you insert like the attitude or behavior you're going to carry out in support of loving yourself.
Oh, that's so good. I love that.
Yeah. It came to me during a race once. And it just, it stuck. And so now I use it kind of across the board in everything.
What race do you remember about when it came to you?
So I was running the Loon Mountain race, which is actually considered like one of the toughest trail races in the country because it has this super, super steep ascent that's like 45% grade at the finish.
Wow. Is this snowshoe or run?
No, this is just a trail
just
race.
Just trail run. Okay.
You know, I was kind of coming off, this kind of goes back to the expectation, but I was coming off a really disappointing race where I had expected to do better than I did. And so I was just kind of feeling down about my running. And I went into the race just wanting to find the joy again in running and just run without expectation. And so, you know, I was on one of the climbs. This race has multiple climbs, but I was on one of the climbs and was just thinking like, you know, I want to find the joy. And when I feel most joyful is about a race is when I know that I've given my absolute all for it. And so, you know, I was thinking about that and thinking about, you know, how that integrity of, or being who you are and staying consistent with that sort of identity of, you know, being in integrity with yourself. You know, I was thinking like, this is actually an act of love for myself if I give my absolute best, if I give everything I have. And so that's kind of where it came from, was like, I love myself, therefore I will give everything I have today. And so I kind of used that as I was climbing up this mountain as a way to kind of just encourage myself, but also like really help me to dig as deep as I possibly could.
Oh, that's amazing. That's so great. We might have to have you do an episode of the Morning Mantra podcast. Watch out, we'll come for you. That brings me to another question that I had, which is about, you're a public figure, essentially. You have a lot of people that, I get your emails now and I love them.
Oh, fantastic.
A lot of followers, people who
read you. One went out this morning.
I know, I pasted a quote from it. If we have time, I'm going to read it. Awesome. That actually relates to what you were just saying. So you must be kind of similar to me and MK, extremely online, or maybe not extremely, but fairly, because there's certainly, there's some kind of an expectation that when really important stories in the running world are out there, that you comment on them or reflect on them in some way, in whatever way fits you and that your audience needs and wants to hear. And I really experienced this when Mary Kane's story came out in early November. How do you filter all of the baggage of the outside world, so that you're addressing the things you need to address without re-traumatizing yourself over and over again? I mean, even I have not been down the road of eating disorders to the extent that Mary Kane has. I've certainly never experienced having a coach like she did. And yet everything about that story just kind of brought my years of feeling terrible about my body and feeling like I needed to be thinner, and the thinnest I could be was the best I could be. I just remember that all came crashing in, and it was for 2 weeks, I felt myself in a real low, and it took a lot to kind of bring me back. And that story is as it should, it continues. And I hope that it does not stop. I want it to not stop. I want to continue retweeting the things that people are writing about it that I think everyone should read. But gosh, it is hard not to constantly be living in that trauma.
Yeah. I think that in that regard, just in terms of like kind of coming across things in media or just in sort of life that are triggering, I saw this phrase recently within the last year, and it really resonated with me, and I felt like I understand it. And it was that where you are triggered is where you are not free. It resonated with me because I feel like I'm kind of at a place now where I can look at some of those stories and kind of read them and be involved in them to whatever extent I am in terms of like sharing or things like that, and not feel triggered in a debilitating way. So certainly it does bring back memories and emotions, but I feel as if the place that I am now and my approach to life now is so vastly different from who I was when I was really struggling, that while there are still memories, that they don't elicit negative reactions now. And, you know, I think too that I try to just have a healthy balance with media and like what I'm consuming and not consuming. And so I think maybe sometimes I have a tendency to be a little bit behind the times because I'm not like on the cutting edge and I'm not sharing story when it breaks and like I'm not like giving my two cents. But then I also feel like there's sometimes when I take a step back and it's like, okay, so am I adding value here? You know, by sharing, by, you know, proliferating, whatever it is, or am I just doing this because everybody else is doing this? You know, and I feel like it needs to be relevant. So I think sometimes I just try to like gauge what the motivation is behind something. And if it truly is resonating with me and I feel strongly about it, then it's definitely something that I will share and speak about. You know, if it doesn't really, and it's just a bandwagon kind of thing, then I tend to like take a step back and just kind of let everybody else do the sharing and the proliferating and tend to not comment a ton.
Yeah. Yeah. You really have to ask yourself, like, what do I need to get out of engaging with this? And what am I getting out of engaging with this?
Exactly. Yeah, totally.
So I'm also curious about the way you experienced, because it sounds like you were really in the throes of, I don't know if it was always bulimia or sort of a pattern of different behaviors, but your eating disorder from childhood into adulthood. And when you went away to college and you left your parents' home, do you remember, were they aware of what you were going through at that point? And did they try to support you? Did you want or need their support at that time? Do you remember how you experienced that?
Yeah. So my eating disorder kind of started as anorexia. And then as I was in recovery for anorexia, kind of morphed into the bulimia. So I think at first the anorexia was very obvious because I was dropping weight pretty drastically between, you know, kind of when my parents dropped me off for my freshman year of college. And then when I saw them again at Christmas, you know, it was a very drastic weight loss within that time period. At that point, I was so miserable and the physical symptoms were becoming kind of scary to me and unbearable that I confessed to my mom and said, I think I have a problem. And so from there, my parents really were very supportive in terms of helping me find the right help back at college where I could find a therapist and a nutritionist to work with, you know. And then it kind of became obvious that it was going to be better for me if I transferred schools to be closer to home. And so they were very supportive in that transition. And so I think all along they were aware and supportive and there. And I think really when things started to kind of transition to the bulimia, it just became less obvious that I was struggling because I was at, you know, a normal weight. Everything that the behavior that I was engaging with was behind closed doors. So it looked like I was eating, you know, healthy amounts, but behind closed doors, I was purging and really struggling. And so at that point, it becomes a lot harder to be supportive if you don't really know what's going on. And the bulimia is what persisted like into my mid to late 20s. Just, I think, because of the secretive nature of it and, you know, because I was just hiding it, really.
Yeah. You get very good at that, I would imagine.
Yes. Yeah.
And so for those of us who have adult children going to college who were and are already aware of the struggles they've had, how do you kind of let go of that closeness that you've had with your child and the engagement that you've had with their recovery when they leave home? And do you have any suggestions or insights about that?
Yeah. You could check back with me in 8 years when my daughter leaves out. You know, honestly, like now that I'm a parent, I don't know how my parents did it. Like,
yeah,
they must have been so scared.
Yeah.
And yeah. It must have been, you know, incredibly difficult for them. So, you know, I think it just kind of goes back to that you know, what I had said earlier, just about being a source of unconditional love and support, you know, and I, there's lots of sort of maybe more practical things you can do. And just in terms of like trying to collect resources for them or trying to make sure that they have supportive friends and a supportive community. You know, I think my parents, I do remember them just encouraging me to like, oh, why don't you get involved with this club? Or like, have you tried going to this? You know, because I think they realized that if I was surrounded by a community of people and friends that could kind of stand in for them in a way, you know, and I think too, like, I can remember they sort of alerted, you know, my counselor at school, at college. And I can remember having a meeting with the dean and like, you know, so they were kind of like trying to bring supportive people in for me and kind of orchestrating that on my behalf, you know? And so I think in some regard that probably did help, you know, at least help me feel seen and connected. And, you know, and I think that's kind of a big part of the struggle is just just helping that person feel seen and heard and loved.
Yeah. Now, were you running in college?
No, I wasn't. I was dabbling in going to the gym and using the elliptical. I had always played team sports, so I had never run cross country or anything like that. So I wasn't a runner. You know, I would maybe like run a mile or, you know, run around the block, that kind of thing. It was really sort of my sophomore junior year of college where I started to run a little bit more just because I had been going to the gym and like just watching the calories on the elliptical machine and it was like a way of like calories in, calories out. And the running, at least, like it got me outside and I felt free when I was running. You know, I kind of would leave like all the disordered thinking and all the stress kind of behind me and just kind of just run and feel good. But at the same time, like there was, of course, there had to be some of that, like, oh, I'm burning calories, you know, wrapped up in it just because my thinking was so disordered at the time. But I really wanted running to be a sign of me being healthy. Like I wanted to be healthy enough to run a marathon. I wanted to be healthy enough to run a 10K and do these races and things like that. Cause it was starting to really interest me, this idea of running and being a runner. So I wanted to be healthy enough to do that. And so I think my recovery was kind of in tandem with discovering running, but really having to kind of learn how to approach it in a healthy way.
Yeah. Yeah, that was what I was going to ask is how did you keep running as you let go slowly and then ultimately in a more definitive way of those behaviors and those thoughts? Was that a struggle?
Yeah. I think it was a struggle because it was very much wrapped up in, you know, this, it was just kind of swapping one thing right. for the other.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and I think it's interesting because I've recently listened to some really fascinating podcasts about the science of movement and just some of the things that are biochemically going on when we move. And this idea that there's this, what did she call it? It's like a hope, hormone that like kind of gets when we move our bodies, when our muscles move. And, you know, along with the endorphins and the oxytocin and, you know, adrenaline that kind of comes along with that runner's high, there's also, it seems like more recent science behind the fact that moving your body actually increases your levels of like hope and self-efficacy. And so I think like maybe that was part of it was that running was the hopeful thing for me that as I moved my body, it gave me, you know, hope that I could recover and hope that I could keep moving forward. And so, you know, I think it was an interesting mix. And there was a time where I totally stepped away from running in my early 20s, where I just stopped running altogether for about 3 years. And that was more due to the fact that I had always wanted to qualify for the Boston Marathon and my marathon times kept getting slower and slower and slower. And so I just kind of gave up. And it wasn't really till after my daughter was born that so this was like 2010 that I started kind of running again. And really when I started running after she was born was the kind of moment where I rediscovered it in its sort of more pure form because it wasn't tied to burning calories or like getting fit or anything like that. So really, yeah, for the last 10 years, I feel like, you know, my running has just been just a really amazing place of kind of self-discovery and growth.
That is, I love that. I love thinking of running every time you go out to run as an act of hope. And especially, I mean, everything that you've said, it's really, and I want the people with the kids in college to think about this too. The thing that really got you over the edge was, you know, in your case, having a child, but, you know, growing, becoming older and wiser. And I do think that that's such a powerful, it's such a powerful story because it shows that there is hope. You know, you can struggle for years to let go of these behaviors, and because and if you're still there and you're showing up for that struggle, then there is hope for you. There are so many people who do get there. They struggle for years, but they get there. And Sarah, this has been so wonderful. And I just the last thing that I wanted to. That I wanted to say comes from your email that you sent out this morning, which was
awesome.
as I was like getting in the headspace to talk to you, it came in and I was like, oh, this is gorgeous. So this was you showing up to a snowshoe race and saying to yourself, I'm quoting you, if you show up and don't do well, it is not consistent with someone going to world snowshoe championships. This is you talking to yourself. Mm-hmm. And then that thought, a lie, was based on the premise that if the outcome was anything less than a win, I wasn't good enough. As I've become acquainted with my mind over the last 37 years, I've realized that these types of thoughts have a tendency to pop up completely at random and unrelated to my current train of thought. They're unannounced intruders. I've gotten pretty adept at dealing with them, whatever facet of life they impact, parenting, relationships, career, and running. So when this little seed of doubt popped into my mind, I wrote about it. I wrote down the lie in my journal, and then I spent about 5 minutes writing all the reasons why this was a totally ridiculous thought, reminding myself of the truth. I'm strong, I'm confident, I'm persistent, and I decided that there was more value in showing up than in staying home. I firmly believe this is the case in every scenario. Show up in your imperfection and your irrational doubts and your lack of proficiency. I read that and it gave me chills.
Oh, good.
And so just to close, what are the ways in which you find yourself confronting these things these days in your now sort of completely new, different life as a mother, a snowshoe racer, a writer, a public figure? How do you put this into practice every day?
Yeah. Even though I kind of have this new perspective and this new sort of outlook, you know, since recovering from an eating disorder, that same sort of ingrained way of thinking, even though I've worked really hard to change it, still kind of like pops up. And it doesn't necessarily pop up in my appearance or weight anymore. Like, I feel like I've worked through those things enough that like those doubts and lies don't really affect me. So, but those doubts and lies still pop up in regards to being a mom and not being a proficient enough parent. Like, oh, I didn't handle that situation very well. I should not have raised my voice. Like, you know, and then the critical thoughts come in like how you're parenting. And I think, you know, it obviously comes in my running. Like, you know, that's a perfect example of feeling like being proficient at something and accomplished in something, but still having these irrational doubts. And then also it comes in being an entrepreneur and a business owner. You know, I've had Rise, Run, Retreat for the past 5 years and definitely have faced moments of doubt and struggle in that journey to create a thriving business. And I think the thing that I just keep coming back to is like, what do I know to be really true about myself? Like, I'm relentless. I'm strong. I'm a fighter. You know, all these I am statements that really firm up who I am and my identity. So I can come back to those things as truth. And I have proof. Like, I can look back at my history of like, I'm strong because look, I battled with an eating disorder for 10 years and like, look where I am now. You know, I'm persistent because look at what I've done with my running. And, you know, I have all these like truths about myself and then examples to back them up. And so that's kind of one way that I kind of go in and really kind of work through that, you know, that negative narrative. And something that I've been doing recently, which is kind of a newer thing, is that, I mean, I've always been a journaler. So I'm always writing and journaling every morning, but every afternoon I go for a walk and I leave my phone and everything at home. And it's like my pep talk walk is kind of what I've been calling it. It's like, I give myself a little pep talk and a little bit of encouragement and like speaking out loud to myself encouragement. My neighbors must think I'm crazy, but yeah, just walking along and just kind of, you know, you've got this, just keep going, you know, and just kind of encouraging myself to keep moving forward.
Keep moving forward. I think that's a perfect note to end on. You do amazing work. We have a lot of people, myself included, who are so grateful for the way you've chosen to be so candidly yourself. And you've put a lot of good in the world for all of us as parents, as runners, as people. So thank you for everything you do. And thank you for your time today. You've been so generous. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate those kind words.
Have a great day, Sarah. Take care.
Okay, thank you.